Welcome to Sunshine Studios. Now, I've been saying Home of the Dead Stripper podcast for the last four chapters, but it's really Home of the Steve Piasecki podcast. Dead Stripper is the first book in the Steve Piasecki series. But a word of caution before you continue. Dead Stripper contains explicit content, such as strong language and depiction of graphic sex and violence, including murder. Therefore, this podcast might not be suitable for all audiences. Forewarned is forearmed. And now, into Chapter 5 of Dead Stripper, where I told you we're going to get into a whole lot of stuff. We'll join Jess and Margo at the Grog Grill for drinks, and Jess will come up with a crazy idea. We'll drop into the Babes in Toyland Strip Club at happy hour, and we'll venture out to Media Station Apartments, where we're going to find a dead body. Scene 13, 5:30 p.m., the Grog Grill, Lancaster Avenue in Bryn Mawr. Jess is sitting at the bar when her cell phone rings. She picks it right up and says, "Hello? You there already?" It's Margo's voice on the phone. "I'm in the middle of the bar. Saved you a seat." The Grog Grill is a chic Irish tavern like you might find in Dublin. And Bryn Mawr is an upscale community on Philadelphia's main line. Jess is finishing her drink when Margo arrives. Margo's good looking, a sleek blonde who exudes confidence. There are no hugs or handshakes when she reaches Jess. They've been friends since kindergarten and see each other often. Margo sits next to Jess. "Just in time," Jess says as she sets her empty glass on the bar. The bartender arrives. "Hey, Margo, what can I get for you?" Margo looks at Jess's glass. "What's that?" "It was a martini," Jess says. "Pass." Margo tells the bartender, "I'll take a Manhattan." "No, wait, make it a margarita." "Frozen?" "Talk me into it." "Another martini for me," Jess says. "Aye, aye." The bartender walks away. "Any luck today?" Margo asks. "I didn't get a chance to go job hunting, if that's what you mean. But I sure got lucky last night. In fact, I got real lucky. You and Pablo made up?" "No way. I went to stay with my parents last night. Then how? I took an Uber, and the driver was gorgeous. So we went to the Black Horse and had a couple drinks. And we did it." "Get the fuck out of here." "Seriously, we did." "Where?" "In the parking lot. Let's see if I've got this right. You screwed an Uber driver. In the parking lot, outside the Black Horse. Right, right, and right. I don't believe it." "Believe it." Jess is smiling, almost ready to giggle. "It sounds like a spike fuck to me. Maybe that's how it started. And how did it end?" "Maybe it didn't end. Maybe I want someone who's there when I need them." "And you think this Uber driver, this stranger you met less than 24 hours ago, you think he'll be there when you need him?" "Steve. His name's Steve. And he listened to my problems, Margo, about getting fired, about Pablo ignoring me. I mean, he really listened. He saw you were drunk, knew you were vulnerable, and scored an easy piece of ass. It wasn't like that at all. He was sympathetic and empathetic. If anything, I talked him into doing it." "Sure you did." "Seriously, I was the aggressor. Anyway, I got his number." The bartender returns with the drinks and sets them on the bar. "Thank you," Margo says. "Put them on my tab," Jess says. "Aye, aye." The bartender moves away to take care of a couple at the end of the bar. "So now what?" Margo asks. "I want to explore my options." "And how exactly do you plan to do that?" "I'll juggle them." "You can't handle Pablo by himself. How the hell are you going to juggle both of them?" "I think I can do it." "For crying out loud. You're actually thinking about pitting Pablo up against this stranger, this Uber driver." "He's not just an Uber driver." "Nah. Who is he? The Prince of fucking Denmark?" "Ha ha. Very funny, Shakespeare. But since you asked, he wants to be a mystery writer. And his ultimate goal is to turn his books into a movie or a Netflix series." "Then why isn't he living in L.A.?" "I didn't ask him that. But please, give him a chance. Wait till you meet him." "How, when, and where is that going to happen?" "I don't know yet." Jess sips her martini and then slips into thought. Several moments pass. Then Jess slams the glass on the bar and snaps her fingers. Scene 14. At the same time. Jefferson Court Apartments. I'm stretched out on the couch in my underwear, watching an episode of Better Call Saul, when my cell phone rings. I grab the phone off the coffee table and answer, "Hello?" "Steve," a female's voice says, "this is Jess, from last night. Remember me? How could I forget? This is short notice, but I just got an idea. I'm listening. I'd love to get together with you again, so I have a proposition for you. You have my attention." Scene 15. At the same time, Babes in Toyland Strip Club. Warren's Cherry Pie is blasting out of 5,000-watt speakers, and floodlights are casting an indigo hue over the entire room. And thanks to businessmen flocking in for happy hour, Babes in Toyland is close to capacity. A blonde's working the poles. She's tall and leggy and calls herself Candy. Strobe lights are pulsating in time with the music, and each ray pinpoints a sequin on her gold lame G-string and sends reflections shooting back toward the audience. Other than the G-string, already stuffed with cash, she's down to a cowboy hat and boots. Candy moves the edge of the runway and winks at a man sitting at the bar right in front of her. She smiles, then pulls down the front of her G-string to give him a peek. He's been eyeballing her all throughout her routine. He reaches into a pocket without moving his eyes and pulls out some cash. She moves closer. He inserts a $10 bill into her G-string. She blows him a kiss, then starts retreating. Cherry Pie fades and American Woman starts playing, the Lenny Kravitz version. The volume's low enough to allow the MC's voice to come booming out over the PA system. "Hey, hey, hey, ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it for Candy." He pauses for enthusiastic applause as Candy exits the stage. "And now, let's bring out our next beautiful showgirl with a great big Babes in Toyland welcome. Clap your hands for Jade." American Woman starts blasting. Jade should be entering the stage, but she's not. The music keeps pounding, but Jade's still nowhere in sight. "Where's Jade?" a female's voice asks. The voice has a twinge of a French accent. She's wearing a harem outfit and has that Middle Eastern look. Dark hair, dark eyes, and darkish skin. She's standing in the back of the room next to Sal the bouncer. "I don't see her," the bouncer says. "No shit, Sherlock." 1 minute later, Candy, still topless, enters the dressing room pulling bill after bill out of her G-string. The room's rectangular and small, but efficient. Mirrors are on all the walls, dressing stations sit every 5 feet, and the counters are filled with makeup, hair dryers, and curling irons. A pink-haired dancer is standing in front of a mirror, primping and preening. Two more dancers are sitting at dressing stations doing the same thing. And two more are standing in the middle of the room. All are wearing skimpy bras and thong bikinis. One of the dancers standing in the middle of the room takes off her top. The dancer standing next to her sprays coconut oil all over the other's back, then starts spreading the oil evenly. The dancer in the harem outfit enters the room. "Where's Jade?" "Ain't seen her," says the girl spreading the oil. "Next girl up." Scene 16. 1 minute later. The manager is sitting behind a desk when someone knocks on the door. "Come in." The door opens and the harem girl enters. She calls herself Farah. She's 25, born in Morocco, and moved to Philly during her teens. "Jade's not here," she informs the manager. "That's not like her, is it?" "Jade's never late." You text her and I'll give her a call." The manager picks up his cell phone. He calls and waits for several rings, but he gets no answer. Then the call goes to voicemail. "Jade, this is Sam from the club. Just wondering where you are. Please give us a call." He ends the call, then looks across the desk at the harem girl. "I just texted her. No reply." Scene 17. At the same time, the Grog Grill. The Grog's crowded, but I can see Jess sitting at the bar. She sees me, lifts up off her stool and waves. It looks like she's sitting with someone else. I reach them quickly. She kisses me on the cheek. "This is my best friend, Margo." "And you're Steve," Margo says with a warm smile. "Yeah," I return a smile. "Barkeep," Jess calls out. The bartender comes over. "Can we get," Jess looks at me, "bottle of, do you have Tecate?" Yeah, we've got Tecate. "Good. I'll take one of those and save the, no glass." "And back us up," Jess says. I remain standing in between them. "No sense beating around the bush," Jess says. Do you have any plans for tomorrow night? Nothing I can think of. Why? What's up? I'm throwing a party, and I'm inviting you. I thought you have a boyfriend. She does. Then how? I start to ask Jess. Simple. You pretend to be Margot's new boyfriend. I look at Margot. You all right with that? I don't have a crystal ball, but this is one of the dumbest ideas I ever heard. Then why? Relax. Margot interrupts. Relax. Jess told me all about you too, hence my skepticism. But she's determined to carry out her crazy plan. I don't think it's so crazy. I do. But under duress, I agree to go along with the charade. But what? I start to ask again. Don't worry. I'm good at playing along. Scene 18. 5:59 p.m. Media Station Apartments. The sun is starting to set as a late model red Camaro rolls slowly down the driveway behind Jade's apartment building. Farrah's behind the wheel and Candy's riding shotgun. Last entrance, Candy instructs her. Farrah drives the end of the driveway, parks, kills the engine. Both front doors swing open and both girls exit the vehicle, now wearing sweaters, tight jeans, and boots. Candy leads the way toward the building and Farrah keeps pace a step behind. They reach a stoop outside the entrance, then climb 9 concrete steps to reach the top. A panel of buttons is inset into the wall, a little below eye level. Step 1, Candy says, is ring the right bell. She stoops down and gets a good look at the panel. Then she runs her index finger along the buttons, finds the one for apartment 201, and presses it. They wait for several seconds, but get no response. Step 2, Candy presses the button again. Several more seconds pass without a response. Candy starts to press the button a third time, but Farrah pushes her hand aside. Step 3, Farrah presses all the buttons. 5 seconds later come a couple buzzes. Farrah opens the door and they enter. Inside are 2 stairways. The one on the right goes up, and the one on the left goes down. Which way? Farrah asks. Up 1 flight. Farrah leads the way. When she reaches the first landing, she opens a fire door and enters a large vestibule. Which way? To the right, apartment 201. Farrah crosses the vestibule and knocks on the door in a rapid staccato. They wait a few seconds but get no response. Then Candy steps up and pounds on the door with both fists. Unbeknownst to them, the door adjacent to apartment 201 opens a pinch. They continue knocking and pounding for another minute but never get a response. Scene 19, 2 minutes later. Candy and Farrah exit the building and start walking briskly toward the red Camaro. Now what? Farrah asks. Let's call Locksmith. Can we do that? Duh. I know we can do that, but will Locksmith open the door on our say-so alone, or shall we call the cops? Ask, and ye shall be answered. A siren's blaring, and emergency lights are flashing as a police car comes speeding down the driveway toward them. It screeches to a stop right behind the Camaro. A uniformed officer exits the car. There they are, a woman yells at the officer. She's in her 60s, well-dressed, and standing on the stoop outside the entrance of the building. She's pointing at Farrah and Candy. Right there, by that red car. A backup police car arrives. A uniformed officer exits that car. He starts looking around, trying to analyze the situation. Both officers come face to face with Farrah and Candy, and the older woman walks right up behind the four of them. These two don't live here, the old woman tells the officers, but they were just causing an awful disturbance outside my apartment door with all their knocking and pounding. Is that true? The lead officer asks. Our friend didn't show up for work, Farrah tells the officer. We called her and texted her, but we never got a response. We're worried, so our boss sent us to check on her. We knocked on her door, but didn't get an answer. The officer turns toward the woman. Where's the manager's office? Scene 20. A few minutes later, the complex manager is using a master key to unlock the door to apartment 201. In his early 30s, he wears his hair in a man bun, sports a scruffy beard, and wears tight jeans. He opens the door, then steps aside. Both officers enter the apartment cautiously. The manager follows them, but stops just inside the door. Nothing looks disturbed or out of place. Still, the officers unfasten the straps on their duty holsters and draw their weapons. "What's her name?" the lead officer asked. "Forsythe. Rita Forsythe." "Rita! Miss Forsythe!" The officers gesture to each other to indicate splitting up. The lead officer heads down a hallway leading further inside, and the backup officer takes the living room. The manager holds his ground in the vestibule. Several seconds pass. "Down here," the lead officer calls out. He's standing halfway down the long hallway. The backup officer reaches him within seconds, and the manager, yielding to curiosity, follows behind until all three men are now standing outside the bathroom door looking inside. "Holy shit," the manager says. Scene 21. 10 minutes later. Two more backup officers arrive and start sealing the apartment with yellow crime scene tape. The lead officer is contacting the county's criminal investigation unit, CID for short. "We found a white female," he tells the dispatcher, "dead at the Media Station Apartments, inside apartment 201. It looks like a drug overdose." The dispatcher relays the message to the medical examiner's office, to operations, and to forensics. A medical examiner, two detectives, and two evidence technicians are soon en route to the complex. Scene 22. Less than an hour later. A man carrying a medical valise arrives first. He's Dr. Kenneth Nakamura, 53, the county medical examiner. He climbs the interior stairway at a brisk pace and quickly reaches the landing on the second floor. He opens a fire door and sees yellow tape crisscrossing the open doorway of apartment 201. Two uniformed officers are standing on the other side of the tape. The lead officer sees him coming. "No need to rush, Doc. She's dead." "Then I guess I'm not needed here." "Good one, Doc." The officer separates the strands of tape to make it easier for him to enter. Dr. Nakamura ducks under the tape, then asks, "Where is the individual in question?" "I called it in as an accidental OD. I will keep that in mind. But things are not always as they seem. Which way, please?" "This way, Doc." The officer leads him down the hallway, stops outside the bathroom door, then steps aside. Dr. Nakamura stops at the marble threshold and looks inside the bathroom. He sets his valise on the floor, opens it, and takes out a camera. He snaps a couple shots, then, being careful not to disturb anything, he steps inside the bathroom, approaches the bathtub, and stops. He snaps pictures from 9 angles. Then he places the camera back inside the valise and removes a voice recorder. Victim appears to be a white female, body in prone position inside bathtub. Appears to be nude, head somewhat elevated above surface of bathwater. Body submerged beneath bathwater. Quantity of bubbles floating on surface, obscuring bulk of body beneath surface. Approximate age appears to be within 2 years of 24. He takes a pair of rubber gloves out of his valise and puts them on. He steps toward the body, presses his fingers against the victim's carotid artery, and holds that position for several seconds. Victim dead at scene. Time of death appears to be 12 to 18 hours prior to discovery of body. He sticks a thermometer in the water. Observe dangling earrings, gold, both ears. Also observe heart-shaped necklace, gold, around victim's neck. He removes the thermometer from the water and looks at it. Water temperature, 68 degrees. Then his eyes go right to the vanity. Observe small mirror on vanity next to sink. Said mirror rectangular in shape, approximately 4 inches by 6 inches. Observe powdery white residue on surface of mirror. Also observe one razor blade, single edge, next to said mirror. He retrieves the camera and snaps several pictures of the vanity. Then he steps closer. Observe one small plastic baggie next to said mirror, approximately 2 inches by 3 inches. Also observe similar white powdery residue inside baggie. Then he pauses the recorder. "Like I said, Doc," the officer says, "accidental OD. When you find drug paraphernalia in close proximity to the victim, for sure, 99 times out of 100, you're looking at a drug overdose. So your impulse is probably correct. But what do you make of the fact that this poor soul is still wearing her jewelry?" To tell you the truth, Doc, I can't see any jewelry from where I'm standing. I see. Dr. Nakamura goes back to his valise and removes a pair of tweezers. He uses the tweezers to lift the baggie carefully and high enough to get a good look at the reverse side of the baggie. Then he snaps a couple pictures of the baggie. Scene 23, 1 minute later. Detectives Pam Bishop and Gary Gerber arrive at the scene. They both appear to be in their early 30s. Detective Bishop is a brunette, shapely, and moderately attractive. Detective Gerber is medium height, average build, and sporting a few days of uneven stubble. One of the backup officers escorts them down the hall to the bathroom. There, they encounter Dr. Nakamura, who's still assessing the scene. "Notice anything, Pam?" Dr. Nakamura asks. "You mean, other than the drug paraphernalia on the vanity? We will get back to that momentarily. Yes, but other than that, do you notice anything out of the ordinary?" Exercising caution, she steps inside the bathroom, then looks at the body in the bathtub. "Well, she's still wearing her earrings and necklace. Very observant. Now, as the only female present, when you take a bath, assuming you take baths and not showers, do you wear your jewelry or do you remove it? Makes no difference. Everything comes off. Unless I'm in a hurry, then I might leave my earrings in, but not dangling ones like those. As I thought," Dr. Nakamura steps toward the vanity. "Now, take a look at this and tell me what you think." He uses the tweezers to lift the baggie, then flips the baggie over to reveal UBER stamped in black on the reverse side. "First time I ever saw that. Detective Gerber, can you see this from where you're standing?" "I can. Me too. I never saw a baggie stamped with the Uber trademark before." "Then we are all in agreement." Dr. Nakamura carefully returns the baggie to the way he found it. "Now give me your impressions of the residue." Detective Bishop steps close to the vanity and takes a good look. "Looks like coke or heroin. My impression as well. I'm leaning toward heroin," she says, "but the color looks a touch off." Two evidence technicians appear outside the door. "Gentlemen," Dr. Nakamura greets them, "just give us a few more seconds and she's all yours." Detective Bishop exits the bathroom. Dr. Nakamura pauses to take one last look around, then he gathers his equipment, steps outside. "All yours," he tells the evidence techs. Dr. Nakamura and the two detectives start walking up the hallway. "Do we have a name?" Detective Bishop asks him. "Forsythe, Rita Forsythe." "Thanks, Ken." "Gary, check out the living room. I'll take the bedroom as soon as I get back." "Where are you going?" "Downstairs. I want to talk to those two women outside, see if they can provide anything of value." "I'll walk out with you," Dr. Nakamura says. They start walking. "So, Ken, how are you going to handle this?" "At least for right now, I'm going to write it up as an apparent drug overdose accidental. Other than the jewelry, which may or may not be meaningful, I don't see anything to contradict that assumption." Scene 24. 2 minutes later, Dr. Nakamura and Detective Bishop exit the apartment building, then go their separate ways. Dr. Nakamura walks toward a station wagon, and Detective Bishop heads toward the red Camaro. The two dancers are standing behind the Camaro, accompanied by one of the backup officers. Detective Bishop reaches them and displays her badge. "I'm Detective Bishop, the Delaware County Criminal Investigation Division." The dancers nod. "I regret to inform you that Miss Forsythe is deceased." "That's pretty much what we figured," Farris says, "you know, when we saw the coroner's wagon show up." "How are you two acquainted with the deceased?" "We work together." "Where?" "At Babes in Toyland on Columbus Boulevard." "I see." Detective Bishop produces a small notebook, opens it, and asks for names and contact information. She jots the information down, then asks, "How is it you came here today?" "She didn't show up for a shift," Barrett says. "We tried calling and texting, but she didn't answer. She never misses work, and she's never late. So our manager sent us to check on her." "What's your manager's name?" "Sam. Sam Cohen." Detective Bishop jots his name in her notebook. "When was the last time either one of you saw her?" "Last night at the club." Detective Bishop looks at Candy. "Same. Do you have any idea how she left for work or who she left with?" Neither dancer knows. And that's the end of chapter 5. Join us next time for Chapter 6, where we'll pick it up the next morning at Steve's apartment. My friend will drop in for a visit. He'll get the lowdown on Steve's score with Jess. And Steve comes across like Sigmund Freud. See you next time.